Our Father, we pray that thou wilt give us clear minds to understand positions that are not our own, and the ability and the concern to critique these positions from the standpoint of holy Christian faith. We thank thee for what thou hast done in our lives, and we pray that as a result of this class and the other classes that we're taking here, we may become more effective in presenting that gospel to those who need it as much as we have. Be with us this hour, for Jesus' sake. Amen. All right. What is philosophy? What, by the way, if you're not taking philosophy, as they say on the airlines, you should disembark immediately so that you're not taken to the wrong location. What? Everyone for philosophy, yes? All right. What is philosophy? What is philosophy? Well, the popular conception of it, of course, has to do with one's own personal way of life or one's personal orientation. My philosophy of life, your philosophy of life, our way of looking at the world. Or people speak of national philosophy, the country's general value system. But this is very, very vague. Can we be helped etymologically? Well, the word philosophy comes from two Greek words, philein and sophia, to love wisdom, the love of wisdom. That isn't awfully helpful either, because nobody is against wisdom, I suppose, at least in formal terms. It's sort of like apple pie, motherhood, and the flag. And there's always a problem, of course, with these Greek derivations. You know the incident of the man who went into the Greek tailor's shop with his trousers over his arm, and the tailor said to him, "Euripides?" And he replied, "Eumenides." Oh, dear, we don't have a classical group here. No, we don't. No, we don't. I thought you were supposed to be taking Latin and Greek. Fie, fie, fie. In early Christian times, Christ was identified as the philosopher, you may be interested to know, in the first three centuries of the Christian era. And you have no idea how this pains me as a good Lutheran to quote Benedict XVI. This is Benedict XVI's latest encyclical, Spe Salve, 2007. This is section 6 of the encyclical. The figure of Christ is interpreted on ancient sarcophagi principally by two images, the philosopher and the shepherd. Philosophy at that time was not generally seen as a difficult academic discipline as it is today. Rather, the philosopher was someone who knew how to teach the essential art, the art of being authentically human, the art of living and dying. To be sure, it had long since been realized that many of the people who went around pretending to be philosophers, teachers of life, were just charlatans who made money through their words, while having nothing to say about real life. All the more, then, the true philosopher who really did know how to point out the path of life was highly sought after. Towards the end of the 3rd century, on the sarcophagus of a child in Rome, we find for the first time, in the context of the resurrection of Lazarus, the figure of Christ as the true philosopher, holding the gospel in one hand and the philosopher's traveling staff in the other. With his staff, he conquers death. The gospel brings the truth that itinerant philosophers had searched for in vain. In this image, which then became a common feature of sarcophagus art for a long time, we see clearly what both educated and simple people found in Christ. He tells us who man truly is and what a man must do in order to be truly human. He shows us the way, and this way is the truth. He himself is both the way and the truth, and therefore he is also the life which all of us are seeking. He also shows us the way beyond death. Only someone able to do this is the true teacher of life. Great passage, great passage. But Benedict, he is a German theologian, he is not just the Pope. And that explains a great deal. All right. Just before I left France, I had the misfortune to read a review in the Dernière Nouvelle d'Alsace, of a new book by a lame brain. This work is entitled Le Christ Philosophe, Christ the Philosopher. Mm-hmm. According to this gentleman, Frédéric Lenoir, and it's got just the name for it, Le Noir, the black one, he regards Christ as the philosopher, not in the way in which Benedict talks about Christ as the philosopher, but as a revolutionary, essentially, a religious revolutionary. What Christ stresses, his philosophy, is that of interior spirituality. You know, this is sort of a New Age kind of thing. And religious liberty against the Jewish establishment, and the desacralization of things, and the rejection of power. Jesus is against established religion and formalism and creeds and stuff like that. Well, a lot of nonsense. Don't bother to buy it. It's also too expensive. €19, that's just awful. $25 for this sort of thing? All right. Now, of course, today we don't think of philosophy in these terms, in any formal sense. Today, philosophy is, as Benedict suggests, a difficult academic discipline. And we'll see that it consists of a number of subtopics, and we'll be taking up a good number of these. From the syllabus, which of course you don't have, from the syllabus you would have seen that we're going to deal with metaphysics, epistemology, ethics, philosophy of science, philosophy of history, aesthetics, philosophy of religion. What do these terms mean? Well, we'll see as we move along. But in general, philosophy deals not with the what questions or with the how questions. It doesn't deal with a scientific description of things, nor with a kind of engineering effort to find out how things function and tick. It deals with the why questions. Why is there a world? That's metaphysics. Why is there a world at all? Epistemology. What is truth? Truth in general. Ethics. What is the good? Plato talked about the philosopher dealing with the good, the true, and the beautiful. The good, the true, and the beautiful. The good is of course, ethics. The true is epistemology. And the beautiful is aesthetics. Well, the first why question we want to deal with is, why study the subject anyway? Why study? Well, here are a series of possible reasons for taking a philosophy course. First, you can't graduate without it. Second, to earn a living. Thirdly, to discover the nature of the universe. Fourthly, to understand human thought. And fifthly, to become a better critical thinker. Let's look at each one of these. To graduate? Well, yes. Yes, you better take this course. You better be nice to me. Graduation might depend upon it. So that's a consideration. But obviously, this is at the very bottom of the list of reasons to do this. To earn a living. Sorry, you're not going to be able to earn a living. The only person in this room earning a living on philosophy is myself. Okay? A number of years ago, there was a comedy program on television called Saturday Night Live, and they had various parodies of commercials and that sort of thing. And at that time, there was a famous writer's school that encouraged people to sign up for correspondence courses in writing. And so they had somebody appear on Saturday Night Live announcing the famous philosopher's school and giving the same kinds of arguments. And he said, for example, you have no idea how badly epistemologists are needed these days. There's an open opportunity for a job in epistemology. Nonsense. There are no jobs in epistemology per se. This is not the route for taking a course in philosophy. How about discovering the nature of the universe? Well, that's not a bad idea. makes me think of an essay of Woody Allen's of a number of years ago. My philosophy, can we know the universe? My God, it's hard enough finding your way around in Chinatown. Great line, I think. Great line. Try London Soho after that if you think you can understand the nature of the universe philosophically. You're crazy. Why is it that you are not going to be discovering the nature of the universe through a study of philosophy? Well, here's a hint. This entire course is going to show you why that's the case, but here's a hint. In the history of science, one theory will replace another on the basis of critical experiments. All right? Thus, the Copernican system replaced the Ptolemaic system. Thus, Einsteinian physics embraced and replaced as a complete explanation Newtonian physics. All of this as a result of serious scientific investigation. But in philosophy, nothing has ever replaced anything. Every philosophical position that ever has been presented is still there and available. The landscape is absolutely littered with them. Now, that suggests something. It suggests that there is no way to demonstrate within the framework of philosophy the falsity of positions to such an extent that you are left with a true position. Okay. I had a philosophy teacher once who said, philosophy certainly knows the questions, it just doesn't know the answers. Or, philosophy certainly knows the problems, it just doesn't know the solutions. You will find that the clear statement of the questions, the clear statement of the problems, is often the most that that philosophy is able to achieve. But that's not trivial. It's very important to get the questions clear. As for the difference between philosophy and science, there is the old line that the scientist learns more and more about less and less until he knows everything about nothing. And the philosopher knows, studies less and less about more and more until he knows nothing about everything. Huh? In other words, the scientist is working with particulars and the philosopher is working with generalities. How about to understand human thought? Well, here we're getting closer. One thing a philosophy course could do for you is to expand your mental furniture, to increase your mental furniture, to expand your mental horizon. There was an advertisement for the Encyclopedia Britannica years ago. How long has it been since your mind has been stretched by a new idea? For many people, their minds have never been stretched by a new idea. They are so narrow-minded that they can see through a keyhole with both eyes simultaneously. One value in studying philosophy is that it introduces you to a vast number of new ideas, and it thereby provides a basis for you to understand better what's going on.
Show us a copy.
That's fine. Just one copy?
She's got some.
What? Oh, there they are. Okay. All right, fine. Good. That's a start. All right. And from a Christian standpoint, you know, we are told that God impacts everything in the world. And we're supposed to, what, as Genesis says, subdue the earth. We're supposed to understand the full gamut of ideas and subdue these in terms of the gospel. In the New Testament, you've got the passage in Colossians about Christ being the cement that holds the universe together. In him all things consist. Or Luther, I've got to quote Luther after I've quoted Benedict, surely. Luther, Christ is present in the leaf of every tree, the real presence. This is why Lutherans don't have any trouble with the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. Of course, he's present there for a specific purpose, which not so in the leaf of every tree. But the idea is the same. The fact of the matter is that as a result of creation, everything is touched by the Creator God, and studying viewpoints is going to be a study that will also have something to do with God's activity in the world. All right? And then, leading on from that, the understanding of human thought to a greater extent, witness to non-Christians. This is a point that Chancellor Ferris makes. He often says to the parents of potential students who are wondering why pagans are being studied here, pagan philosophers and the like, that this is a way of establishing a common ground with non-Christians and a way of evangelizing on that basis. It's a kind of pre-evangelism. And that's quite correct. The non-Christians are deeply impacted by secular philosophical ideas. There's no question about this. And if we don't understand these ideas, we can hardly become a Jew to the Jew and a Greek to the Greeks in order to help them to move to the gospel. And if we arrive at the point where we understand why these non-Christian philosophical positions don't work, then we're able to help them to see the same thing. And by process of elimination, in a sense, we can provide them with the case for Christianity as offering the answers to these same issues. Now, we are not suggesting that the work of a non-Christian philosopher, for example, is going to be 100% negative. Why? Well, the only way for you to read a book or work with a thinker who is 100% negative is to choose the devil as your subject matter. Any human being, no matter how unfortunate the general position is going to have some good stuff in it. No doubt about this. Why? Because we're living in a world that is a created world, a fallen world, but a created world. So God's impact is there. In reading the philosophers, you are going to come across some very valuable positive material, not just the negative stuff. Okay. And finally, to become a better critical thinker. In my opinion, that is the chief value of studying philosophy. It improves your critical faculties. And the assignments in this course are designed to assist you along that very line, as we will see in just a moment. On the inability of traditional philosophy to get suitable answers, I ran across a statement. This is in an advertisement for a French encyclopedia of philosophy, which I unfortunately spent €100 to obtain. The philosopher who is quoted in the sales pitch is someone you'd never have heard of and never will, and Ernst Bersot, B-E-R-S-O-T. And this is what he said. One is not a philosopher because one finds, but because one searches. Exactly. All right. I say that the course is set up to assist you to think critically as well as to expand your horizons in the history of human thought. How is this achieved in our course? Well, first of all, there are a ton of readings. Good, serious philosophical readings. And to make sure that you do good, serious philosophical reading, we are going to have spot quizzes.
Yeah.
Starting in the fourth week. And so it is very important that you do your readings ahead of time. You will have these on roughly one a week, something like that. Obviously, a quiz, short answer kind of thing, cannot arrive at a level of great profundity, but it will ensure that everybody keeps up on readings, and that's what we're aiming for. Yes, sir.
Is there like a list of the assigned readings in here? Because I can't find it.
Yeah, should be there.
Okay. So page five.
Maybe you didn't get page five.
Okay.
Yeah, see, you have a list of the required books, and then we've listed the readings just by the author's name and the page numbers. I hope we have. Yes? Everybody think that's what's going on? Mm-hmm. All right.
Sorry.
Suppose I could check my copy if worse comes to worse.
I think it is on the last page.
Yep. Let's see here. It is indeed. All right. The quizzes will count probably a quarter of the grade for the course.
Right.
That is the average of the quizzes. The major assignment is a class presentation and accompanying paper, research paper, dealing with a great philosopher or great thinker. And if you take the first of the fatter of the items that I distributed at the very beginning, and you turn to pages 2 and 3, just turn over the first page, you will see a slew of topics. These are the names of great thinkers. And we have a couple of additions to this, which I will get to at some point. The idea is this. At the class meeting on Monday, you need to give me a sheet of paper with your name at the top, and 7 of these thinkers in the order of preference that you would want to work on. Okay? The top of the list of 7, the one that you would especially like to work on at position 7, the one that you'd least like to work on. The reason for 7 is because of the Baptists who are probably here in the class, and Baptists always feel so much better when things are given in 7s. You will turn in to me on Monday your sheet of paper. And I will then, on the following class period, a week from today, give you the topic from this list that you'll be working on. I will try to give you a topic high in your list. But what we must have is to have everybody working on a different topic. That's the reason for doing it this way. Now, these presentations begin in the fourth week. That's early. But we are especially generous to the early presenters because the early presenters have not had the benefit of seeing their friends destroyed gently criticized, and therefore they are in a more vulnerable position because they're presenting early. We get tougher as the time goes on because you have gotten the benefit of the criticism of other papers. The papers are to be between 10 and 12 pages in length, roughly, but this depends upon how fast you speak, in a sense, because you will have a class period, and you will not be able to use more than 35 minutes for your presentation. There'll be 35 minutes for your presentation and 15 minutes for discussion and evaluation. And on Wednesday, a week from today, I will tell you when you're presenting also. You'll get the topic and you'll also get the date on which you are presenting. And later on in this period, I'm going to show you how to do such a paper. So you're not going to be flying blind in that respect. If none of these 80 topics are a great fascination to you, and there's someone you would desperately like to work on, and you feel that person is significant, I will need to hear about that on Friday, all right, so that I can indicate what the situation is relative to that. Make sure that you are included among everybody else in the final determination of the topics. As to a final examination, if there is one, it'll count about a quarter, but it may be that if the quizzes are very good and the presentations are very good, there will be no final examination. It will simply be a matter of, say, two-thirds on the paper and one-third on the quiz total. But that depends. If there is a final examination, then that would count about a quarter of the total.
Yes.
Well, how do you prepare a philosophy paper like this? We'll talk about the content of the paper, and then we'll talk about the format of the paper. Fair enough? As to the content of the paper, you want to distinguish clearly between exposition and criticism. Exposition and criticism. I suggest that you divide the paper into two major sections, exposition and criticism. Exposition is your objective presentation of the viewpoint of the person you have chosen. Critique is your evaluation, positively and negatively, of that person's position. It is a fatal mistake to blend these two together. If you try to blend them, no one knows when you're presenting the other person's viewpoint and when you're criticizing the other person. And a good way to avoid that problem is to make a clean distinction in the paper between the presentation of that person's ideas and then later on the critique of that person's ideas. What's the test of the effectiveness of the exposition? If the person you are presenting were there listening to it, he would say, "Exactly, I couldn't have said it better myself." You are trying to present that individual's viewpoint as faithfully as you possibly can. You leave your own ideas out of it in the exposition section, as it were. Your time will come. Your time comes in the critique section of the paper. One big mistake that's made in Christian circles is that we go running out criticizing people without really understanding them. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, what that does is to create a very bad press. And once the non-Christian sees that we haven't even taken the time to understand him, he's not especially interested in our presentation of the gospel. We have got to learn to listen, to understand what the non-Christian is saying before we jump in with all fours to try to show him how wrong he is. Even if that's the best way to do it, and I'm not sure it is. All right. Now, how do you do the exposition then? Well, it's a good idea to give background to the person's ideas. That is, to try to set him in the context of his time and maybe into the context of the general history of the ideas that he's presenting. So, it's nice to move from the more general to the more specific. And when you get to presenting his own ideas, you do this on the basis of primary sources. What do I mean by primary sources? I mean you go to the horse's mouth. You actually read the person that you're dealing with, and you quote him. This isn't just a string of quotations, but you actually use the person's own material there with appropriate footnote citations and the rest of it. You will also want to use responsible secondary sources. These are people who've written about the person you're dealing with. But you've got to be very careful there. You don't want to present someone's ideas on the basis of what somebody else says those ideas are. It's not what somebody says about somebody. It's what the individual himself is saying about himself. A good rule of thumb is that you don't go along with a secondary interpretation of what a person is saying unless that can be backed up from reading the person himself. Okay? And in the exposition, at the end of it, usually it's the best place to do it, at the end of it, you try to get at the most fundamental of the person's ideas, his presuppositions, the ideas that are the most basic to what his entire position represents. If you do this, it facilitates the critique portion of the paper immensely. Because when you go into critique, you want to be focusing on the very central, most fundamental ideas that the thinker is presenting. You know, if you want to tear down a building, for example, you don't go up on the roof and begin ripping slates off of the roof. It's going to take you a tremendous length of time if you do it that way. What you do is you go down to the basement of the building and you find those elements in the foundation of the building that hold the whole building up, and you get rid of those, and then the whole thing collapses. By the same token, that's the way to do critique, to get at the fundamental ideas. And if the fundamental ideas create a problem, then, of course, everything else is going to go down with them. Well, we're getting into critique, aren't we? How do you do the critique? Well, there are two main ways of doing a critique, and they both ought to enter in if it's appropriate for your particular thinker. The first is a historical critique. That is showing advantages and disadvantages to that thinker's position as revealed in the history of thought. Has his position led to all sorts of catastrophic results? Has there generally been a movement away from his thinking for very good reasons? This sort of thing. There you're engaged in a comparison of what he holds with what other people hold who have been dealing with more or less the same sort of thing. Now, of course, that doesn't get to the heart of a critique, because the best you can do there is to say, for example, among imbeciles, he was the least imbecilic. All right? Or, you know, among clever people, he was slightly less clever than they, or whatever. You need to move on from a historical kind of criticism to a criticism in terms of the truth value of this viewpoint. I mean, is it a sound viewpoint, or isn't it, for goodness sake? And here, there are three things that need to be done. First, internal criticism. This is determining whether his position is internally consistent or not. There are some philosophical positions that fall by their own weight simply because they are not even consistent internally. There's a lack of cohesion in the position. If we were dealing with a religious philosophy, for example, we could think in terms of Christian Science. Christian Science, which is, of course, neither Christian nor scientific, so it's an unfortunate misnomer. But in the case of Christian Science, you know, Mrs. Eddy claimed that there is no evil and there is no pain whatsoever. And yet, Christian Science maintains healers. Well, if there's no problem, what are the healers up to, for goodness sake? Technically, the healers are to help people to see there isn't any pain. But obviously, these function as quasi-medical personnel, right? And that's why Christian Scientists have ended up in court for having kept people from responsible medical treatment. There's an internal inconsistency there in this thing. Okay, now, even if a position is completely coherent, that doesn't mean it's necessarily true. Some of our finest paranoiacs have been completely consistent. Take my Uncle Oscar, for example, who is convinced he's followed by Albanians. All right? Uncle Oscar is convinced he's followed by Albanians. And you say, well, for example, he says, well, Schultz, the nice Lutheran owner of the candy store. You say, Schultz? Why, he gives candy to children, and he's sweet, and he also holds to really good theology, not like those Baptists. And Uncle Oscar says, they're tricky, those Albanians. Uncle Oscar is completely consistent. They're always Albanians involved in this kind of thing. They may not look like Albanians, but they certainly are. Huh? So, to be consistent, to have complete consistency, is no evidence of truth. So you got to go beyond internal criticism. You go to External criticism. What is this? This is evaluating the position by comparison with external facts. Do the facts support the position? Do the facts outside of the system support the system or not? In the case of Christian Science, I don't know why I'm using that as an illustration, but the Christian Science, there is no pain, right? And there's a story of the person who listened to this Christian Scientist say this. Most Christian Scientists, I'm sorry to say, tend to be middle-aged, rather overweight women. I don't know why this is the case. And I'm sorry if I'm being chauvinistic, but I mean, statistically, this does seem to be the situation. And anyway, after this one particular Christian Scientist said, there is no pain, a friend took a hat pin, and as she was bending over, stuck her with it. And of course, she leapt into the air with a tremendous shriek. And when she calmed down, she said, I will admit this, the illusion of pain is almost as bad as the pain would have been. Now, if you've got to predicate of the illusion everything you would have to predicate of the reality, you're not saying anything when you say it's an illusion. You see? I mean, the external facts happen to contradict the notion that there is no pain. Or, you know, to take a more serious list, Dachau, Buchenwald, and that sort of thing, the death camps of the Second World War. Okay, so internal criticism, that has to do with consistency. External criticism, that has to do with fitting the facts. And thirdly, there is ideological criticism. This is criticizing the viewpoint from the standpoint of your own viewpoint, assuming that you can support your viewpoint. Now, people here would be criticizing these positions from a Christian standpoint. Little doubt about it. Does this mean you have to go into apologetics in your paper? You can't. It's too short a paper to do that. But it's important at least to stick in a footnote if you start ideological criticism and say something like this. We are not criticizing Immanuel Kant simply because he is not a Christian. We are not criticizing him because we feel that Christianity is true. The fact of the matter is there is overwhelming solid evidence in behalf of historic Christian faith, and thus we are permitted to use this as a basis of evaluation. Footnote. And then you cite some apologetic stuff, you know, just in the footnote, to show a reader that you are not gratuitously using your faith as a basis of pounding on somebody else. You want to show that you're not a fideist, a person who just uses his own faith as if it were true without any evidence for it. But obviously, you can't go into any extensive apologetic in a paper like this. Now, very important point, which I've alluded to before, in the critique, you are giving positive and negative critique. Only if your subject were the devil would there be nothing positive. And I've not listed the devil among the various... And he hasn't done any books under his own name either. So that would be more difficult to put him in. Any human writer, it's going to be a mixture. Now, you know, in some cases, it's awfully hard to find something nice to say. Mein Kampf, for example. I mean, if you were doing Hitler's. No, it's not... The topography is very good in the book. Wonderful German Fraktur type. You know, you could say that, I suppose. But in terms of the content, it's really hard to get some good stuff there. But you've got to try to be balanced in this. And see the good for what it is. All right. Now... How do you collect your sources? How do you get the material to do a paper like this? Let me tell you about three mistakes you can make. Here's a big mistake. Just going to the library and using the stuff there. Problem with this is that Patrick Henry's library is small, but even if it were large, it doesn't necessarily have the important stuff on your topic. So, interlibrary loan is important. Early topics may not have time to do this, but there are other libraries, of course, within driving distance, and you could certainly work with materials other than at the one single library. So it's a big mistake just to try to use the stuff that's in one library. An even bigger mistake is just to go to the library card catalog or to the equivalent of it, the web catalog for that library, and use the materials that are listed there. Why? Because books come into libraries for a variety of reasons, not just the quality of the material. When I was head librarian of philosophy and theology at the University of Chicago, I ordered a book entitled How to Grow Plants Through Prayer. And I got a call from the cataloging department. They said, Montgomery, you've lost it. I said, I have not lost it. This is an important sociological document. If there are people who actually think, A, that they can grow plants through prayer, or B, that it's a good idea to try, that ought to be in our library to show people what kind of religiosity we're facing these days. Or at the Patrick Henry Library, there might be a book on Nietzsche, which was written by the son of the major donor. And the major donor might have given this book to the library. Are they going to throw it out? Are you kidding? Certainly not. And yet it may be absolutely ghastly. Right? So you can't just assume that because the book's in the library, it's going to be an authoritative source on your subject. Fair enough? And the biggest mistake you can make is to go to the web and Google things and think that you can automatically take the stuff that you find there. The reason why that's an even bigger mistake is because in the case of the material on the net, you can't really be sure that the stuff has been accurately transcribed, accurately identified. The value of the web and the value of a card catalog in a library is as a preliminary tool, never as a final source. Well, you say, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Suicide appears to be the only possibility now. No, what you do is to go to authoritative reference sources. Authoritative reference sources to find out the materials that are to be used in doing a topic like this. And out of the goodness of my heart for this reason, the very first page of what I've distributed is a list of reference aids for philosophy essays. So, you take your topic, And you go, for example, to Paul Edwards' Encyclopedia of Philosophy. You look up that topic, and at the end of the article will be a bibliography of solid materials on that subject. Okay. Therefore, you could be confident in using those materials because an expert in the field has, in a sense, validated them by employing them as sources for his encyclopedia article, etc. You want to be able to support any sources you use. Now, here, of course, I'm talking about secondary sources and critical sources. Where the primary sources are concerned, there's less of a problem. And if you're working on Plato, for goodness sake, you just go to a standard edition of Plato and cite it. There's not any difficulty there. And in the case of classical philosophers, it's a good idea to use the classical citation, which are the original paragraph numbers that appeared in the early editions, rather than the page number of the particular modern edition that you're employing. But that's a minor issue. All right. Format. How about format? Well, length. We've already talked about the length. There is this wonderful line, how long should a research paper be? It should be like a woman's skirt. It should be long enough to cover the subject, but short enough to be interesting. Yes. A chauvinistic comment, but there you are. In our case, you're going to be presenting your paper within 35 minutes. 35 minutes maximum. And the length of your written material should have some bearing on this. But you don't have to read the paper as such. And the evaluation of the oral presentation is in terms of how well you communicate. So I don't recommend you're simply reading what you have written. I suggest that you read some things, maybe the more difficult material, but try to do it from outline. And you can use overheads or PowerPoint or stuff like that if you want to. The oral presentation is based, the evaluation of it is based upon your ability to communicate this philosopher or thinker and your critique to people who don't know anything about him but who are of college level. All right? The written material, the model is a scholarly journal article. Meaning that probably the written material will be a little bit more stuffy. You could argue that it would be nice if journal articles were less stuffy, and you could try your best to, you know, reduce the amount of stuffiness per cubic inch to the extent that you possibly can. That would be a nice idea. All right. You're going to have footnotes. And the footnotes are better at the foot of the pages than all collected at the end. They're better for you if you're presenting from the paper because you can see your notes right away, and they're better really for the reader for the same reason. But if you want to collect them all at the end, that's perfectly okay. What you must do is to use a uniform system of citation. The most common one is Turabian. That's a short version of the University of Chicago style manual, and that's available in the paperback. You can buy this. It's a good idea to have it. But you don't have to use that. There's the Modern Language Association style manual. There are scientific style manuals. You could even use a scientific style. But what you mustn't do is to use a kind of charismatic approach to footnotes, you know, where a spirit moves you to stick in a particular style here and another style there. The thing has got to be consistent. Okay? Yes. I would suggest three copies of the paper. And they all have to be ready at the beginning of the period that you're presenting. One copy goes to me. You probably will have one of them marked up to help you in your presentation, and another unmarked copy. At the end of my evaluation of this, I will exchange my annotated copy for your unmarked copy. All right? That way you will get my critique, chop chop, and be able to benefit from it. And I will have the copy of the paper that you have done in its pristine condition. I don't imagine, to go into the evils of plagiarism, do I? Because this is, after all, a Christian institution, and I have mafia contacts in Sicily, which you should keep in mind always. Yes, yes, some students have never been seen again. They've become part of foundations of public buildings, and thereby contributed to modern culture. Anytime you cite, you must give the source. Now, this is for, serious ideas. I had an Old Testament professor once who told me that he had gotten a paper. This was a graduate paper. He got a paper from a student. And in the course of the paper said, and the distance from Jerusalem to Jericho was 38.2 kilometers. And then there's this footnote, and there are 12 German sources cited there to back this up. I mean, this is ridiculous. The distance from Jerusalem, and you can go out there and measure it yourself. It's on any map. I mean, you don't need a footnote for that. And he of course, was absolutely fit to be tied. This was a student who had, he'd absorbed the whole idea of documentation to the point where it had gone to absurdity. So, but whenever you are presenting another person's ideas, or you're presenting quotations from other people, document. And if in doubt, document. All right? Not to the point of the 12 German citations on the distance. But anyway. All right. Yes. How are we doing on time? Ooh, we're getting to the end of the time. All right, any questions on any of this? Yes, sir.
I had a quick question. Can we quote other thinkers to comment, compare them to the thinker that we're...
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes. Those will be secondary, part of the secondary material that you use. Oh, yes. And when you're doing the critique, a good way of doing that in those various sections like internal, external, ideological, that kind of thing, it's perfectly okay to begin with a critique that other people have done and then go on to your own. Yep. Anything else? Yes.
You want that double space, 12.5?
Well, it's best to double space or 1.5 space. Please don't single space. It's a massive type on the page. Yeah, the footnotes are normally single spaced, or the bibliography is normally single spaced within entries at the end and double space between. I don't get awfully excited about this, but our object in this, everybody, is to try to get to the point of doing journal articles, substantial, solid journal articles. And I brought with me to Patrick Henry the Global Journal of Classical Theology, which isn't limited to theological material, and that is now on the Patrick Henry website. And every issue contains three journal articles, and that's published 3 times a year. And there's no reason in the world why some student essays couldn't eventually get into that. There have been student essays from other institutions in the past. I want to try to help you to reach that point. And on the oral presentation, I want you to get to the point where you can persuasively present the ideas of great thinkers and critique them, so that this can have an impact when you make public presentations. So there's a certain practicality to this. Let me see, what else? Oh, yes. If any one of you or more are interested in the summer program in Strasbourg, please see me sometime this month. Technically, the registration deadline for that is the 1st of February. It's an absolutely wonderful experience. It's in the French Rhineland, We have four of the top apologists in the world there in the summer. Two of them on a rotational basis, two of them always the same people. This summer we have Ross Clifford from Australia, the dean of the Moreland Theological College. He's a barrister, solicitor, and a specialist on the cults and the occult. And we have Oliver Wilder Smith, who is the son of the great A.E. Wilder Smith, the anti-evolutionist. Oliver is a physician and deals with scientific apologetics and medical issues. It's an absolutely wonderful experience. And as was mentioned this morning, there are five scholarships that are specifically earmarked for Patrick Henry students. Anything else? I think we're at the end of the time. All right. See you Friday.